This week on Art in the Air features artist and academic known for his visually diverse paintings, David Clayman, who also serves as Dean of Indiana University's Northwest School of Arts. Next, we have St. Joseph, Michigan's Krassel Arts Center's Executive Director and Chief Curator, Tammy Fowler. Our spotlight is on Dune Summer Theater 2023 five-show season and their May 20th soiree with Steve Scott and Elise Cremani.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available on our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our shows are available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for more information about upcoming shows and interviews. Art on the Air is now available on WDSO 88.3 FM Chesterton on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. And we'd like to welcome back to Art in the Air, talking about their 2023 season. And they're going to be real excited about what they've got going on and also other things going on from the Dune Summer Theater. We have the Artistic Director, Steve Scott, and Elise Cremani. Welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thanks, welcome. Larry and Esther. It's good to see you both.
It's quite a season you've put together.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I'm excited about it. I hope other people will be too.
Well, and I noticed that the shows are not really well known, which is actually great to explore some of these lesser known shows that sometimes don't get things. So why don't you start, you know, telling us about the season? And then I should say to everyone, season tickets are out there and we'll talk more about how to get those. But I think your first show opens June 2nd. But tell us about what we got coming this season.
Well, our first show is a kind of classic farce called Boing Boing, which was actually very popular in the 1960s. It's based on a French farce. But it was revived again for Broadway about 15 years ago. And it was a huge hit. And I went to see it at that point and thought it was just amazing because it kind of, you know, most farces kind of make fun of everybody, especially the women in the play. Boing Boing, the women get the upper hand. And I think it makes it perfect for our times now, too. But it basically involves a young French guy who is engaged to three different flight attendants, and he kind of schedules their meetings by their flight schedules. And unfortunately, the flight schedules change. They all end up in the apartment at the same time, along with his best friend, and hilarity ensues. It's a very, very funny play. It's being directed by Jay Espagno, who was in our acting company 2 years ago and is now the artistic director of Pride Arts in Chicago. And he's a master of farce. I've seen a number of his productions, and I think he's going to do a great job of it. So we will start the season with a lot of laughs, I hope.
So, Scott, you had mentioned the Parisian setting. I've seen a version of it where everybody just used, you know, their own accents. Are you going to
everybody's using different accents because the three women are from different countries. There's a German, a woman, a French woman, and an American.
Yes.
So we'll be messing.
I know. I think I was referring just to the man.
Oh, no, the man is Parisian, but he will be speaking kind of unaccented English. Yeah.
Well, you still have five other shows to talk about, so let's get...
Oh, my God, yes. Our second show is Tick, Tick, Boom, which was the first play by Jonathan Larson, who later became very, very famous, of course, for writing Rent. And Tick, Tick, Boom, is an autobiographical musical talking about what it's like to be a late 20, early 30-something and not having achieved the goals that you set out for yourself. And what do you do? It is it's a wonderful musical. It was actually done as a movie a couple of years ago with Andrew Garfield. Basically, it's very funny at times. It's very reflective at times. It is a full evening's entertainment, and the music, as you would expect, is just amazing. And playing the role of John in Tick, Tick, Boom is Max DeTogne, who has been in our company before, and I think is well known to our audience. But I think he's going to do a wonderful job with that. And that starts performances at the end of June. Then our third play is Christopher Durang's play, Masha and Sonia, and Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. I always get the titles screwed up. And it sounds like it's a deep, dark Chekhovian tragedy. It's not. It's about children, three siblings who were the children of Chekhov scholars, which accounts for their odd names. And basically, one sister and the brother live in the family home in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The second sister, who has been a Hollywood star and is now fading, comes back and basically says, I'm going to sell the house and you're going to have to move somewhere. And then we start talking about generational concerns and what do you do as you're getting older. And Masha, the Hollywood star sister, has brought her much younger boyfriend, Spike. So there is a lot of generational talk. It is one of the funniest plays I have ever read. I actually did a production of it at the Goodman Theater in 2015. And it was a tremendous success there. It's been a success pretty much everywhere where it's been done, and we'll hope that that continues at the Dune. But it's a smart play, a very, very funny play, and ultimately a very reassuring play about life and life's journeys and pathways and all of that.
But, well, quickly summarize the other two, because we want to talk about some other things there. We only have about a couple minutes left here, so.
All right. So, well, we have our Broadway Cabaret, which we have done previously at Friendship Gardens. We decided to bring it into our own backyard at the Dunes, because we have a lovely backyard, which we'll be doing in August. And then we'll be doing our first ever New Works Festival. We're going to solicit plays, especially from playwrights in Northwest Indiana, and see what's brewing artistically in our own neighborhood. So we'll be doing readings from several plays second week in September. And I'm very excited about that. I love uncovering talent that I didn't know about, and this will be a great way to do that.
Well, so, Elise, let's punt it over to you and tell us about the spring soiree on May 20th and also season tickets.
Yes, we are encouraging people to get season tickets, $150 for all five plays, including the four plays from the New Plays Festival, and a bunch of wonderful parties, including the Spring Soiree, which is a subscriber-only party with cocktails and appetizers. You can get all tickets at dunesarts.org, front page right there. And if you have questions, call us.
And you can call that number at 219-879-7509. And they're located in Michigan City on good old Shady Oak Drive. We'd like to thank you for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight. And again, we'll have you back to talk about maybe some of the individual shows more in depth and maybe have some cast members here. That's Elise Kermani and Steve Scott, the artistic director. Appreciate you coming on from Dune Summer Theater. Thanks so much.
Thank you. So exciting.
Thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the full one-hour Art on the Air program on Lakeshore Public Radio is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome David Klayman to Art on the Air. David is an accomplished international artist and is represented by Richard Gray Gallery in New York and Chicago. He is currently the Dean of the School of the Arts at Indiana University Northwest and has been with the university since 1985. Thank you, David, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to be here. I appreciate you inviting me.
And nice to see you again. I was there briefly for that little celebration or time I was at the IUN just to kind of get the theater advice there. So, David, we want to know about your origin story. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about your art journey.
Okay. Well, I grew up in rural Illinois. Dixon, Illinois, about 100 miles straight west of Chicago, in a environment that did not have a lot of visual arts present, but with a mother who was always very talented as an artist. And both of my parents were very intellectually curious and active. And so I was always exposed to thinking of new ideas and looking at the world around me in some careful way. My father owned a car dealership, so I grew up with my first sense of aesthetic appreciation probably revolving around new cars. Yeah. And
Did he bring home those wonderful models of cars?
Oh yes,
yes. Aren't they wonderful?
and I spent a lot of my childhood out at the car dealership, looking in and inspecting the cars, and just loving the aesthetic and the implied power of some of the cars. And it was sort of my first awakening of an interest in aesthetics.
Excellent.
So what were you looking at in Dixon? So is Dixon, and I'm not familiar with it, is it farming community? Is it, so what kind of vista were you seeing?
It's mostly cornfields, but we were in a wooded area on the only hill around us. So we routinely got struck by lightning. Ooh. Our house. It got struck by lightning. And so it was a wooded rural area with horses and cattle and cornfields, and some element of the landscape, I'm sure, permanently imprinted itself on me, this massive flat landscape that created a horizon line that was almost a circle that seemed to go all the way around me. Additionally, I had some artists and scientists in my family that were part of our ongoing conversation. A relative of mine was the person who invented essentially sweet corn, hybrid corn, Reed's yellow dent corn, and won a medal at the World's Fair in the late 1800s for this. And another family member of mine had painted a really loving portrait of a single ear of corn to partially document this incredible accomplishment. And growing up with the medal from the World's Fair and the ear of corn there, always helped me create a sense of the connection of thinking and investigating and
science and art.
Yeah, right. So that was science and art has always been part of my interest, study, and continues to be at this point.
So was your mother a painter?
Because
you said she was very artistic, what type of things was she
right?
She made
mostly drawings and was always very talented. She worked as the manager of a local bank, but given the opportunity, I'm sure she would have ended up in the arts in some way, but didn't have that opportunity when she was younger.
So did you have any art influences in school? I mean, it just sounds like, you know, may not be out in the Dixon, but, you know, there might have been something, one teacher or one in early influence in your life.
Yeah, I had a great high school art teacher who really encouraged me and was supportive and let me explore my ideas quite freely. And I had a great high school science teacher as well. And the two of them made significant changes in my way of seeing the world and influenced me in meaningful ways that I'm sure changed the course of my development in life.
What type of work were you doing in high school? I mean, you know, Because I know with mine, we had a broad range of art disciplines to work in, but did you favor one over another?
No, I essentially did what was in class. And so I made ceramics, I did paintings, I did drawings. And in terms of making things outside of class, I did a few extracurricular things that were eccentric discoveries for me. I think of one of them that made my mother quite unhappy with me. I collected lead wheel weights from around the car lot and brought them home and heated them in a pan on the stove, melted them. And then with a bucket of sand, I had pushed my hand in the sand and then poured the lead in and made a life-size cast of my hand out of lead. And it was quite an exciting process for me. And I hadn't given any thought to how toxic or destructive it was.
No, we didn't really think about lead or mercury or
right.
Any of those.
So you had both science and art kind of like in your early influences. What caused you to take the direction you did take? Or was it a firm decision, or you just, as you graduated high school, did you know what you're going to do, or explore that for us?
So I went to University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana and studied both science and art. I began in biochemical communications, and I went through much of the pre-med curricula, as well as the fine arts program, and was a student of philosophy as well. And all the way along my academic career, I've always had one foot in each area. At a certain point, making art became very exciting to me, and the doors of opportunity began to open. For example, getting a wonderful scholarship to graduate school at the Art Institute meant that I had a great opportunity that I should take to explore that part of my creative self.
And of course, a BFA, you really are, unlike a standard bachelor's degree, really is like three quarters focused in art. So at some point early in your college career, you probably had to pull the trigger on that.
Not so much. All the way through, I continued in science and philosophy classes as well. I was an ambitious student who really loved being in the studio at the school and equally loved my science classes. So I took a lot of classes.
Oh, I understand. So you got accepted to the Art Institute in Chicago. And so tell us about that that move and that process and the influences it gave you.
Well, I had never been in a city much before, and it certainly had never lived in one. And so moving from Champaign-Urbana and prior to that being in Dixon, Illinois, to Chicago was quite an eye-opening experience. And I was exposed to so much art and creativity and imaginative people and a competitive environment that really demanded that I make my own personal creative decisions and advocate for myself. And in the end, it showed itself to be an environment that was quite good for me. It gave me exposure to a lot of amazing people and a lot of amazing resources. And the city of Chicago is and was such a remarkable place to find oneself as an artist.
Certainly is.
Oh, yeah, just to be there at the Art Institute itself, I mean, to pop in for 5 minutes, it's just so inspiring.
Well, before we talk about your work, what artists, first of all, you admire and their work, early influences, things that you maybe now admire throughout your life?
Mm-hmm. There are so many. It's almost hard for me to know where to begin.
Because that question almost, I wonder if it relates to your body of work, which takes like a Mondrian and skews the perspective and the orientation, like what brought you to that work? Do you know what you were doing right before you started doing that? And so actually what I'm really wondering is those represented artists in that body of work, are those some of your favorites?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Some of those are even chosen for the frame rather than the actual artwork. I have a deep love and appreciation for minimalist artist Donald Judd and Walter Di Maria, and the Arte Povera artist from Italy, and Yannis Canellis and Giuseppe Pannoni. And and I'm a huge, I hardly even know where to begin in terms of all of the other artists whose work I love. It really is work that looks like mine. I'm a huge fan of John Singer Sargent, who I think is one of the most amazing painters in history. But at the same time, I love contemporary artists like Paul McCarthy so many others. But when I think of what actually influenced the look of my paintings and the kind of paintings that I make, I don't think of myself as being very influenced by other visual artists. I think of my influences as being primarily writers and theorists. And so my ideas really come out of an ongoing exploration of theory in a sense, to use a big word, kind of visual epistemology.
So then, is it an organic process as you go from, because you have very distinct bodies of work, and that you mentioned Sargent, there is like a quality, like in some of the early work, that really is reminiscent of that. So is it an organic process that makes you flow from one body to the next? Because I'm really interested in what you were working on that led you to the body of work that took, that changed the perspective and orientation of, you know, some pretty well-known works.
Right. So to try to summarize that, over the last 20 years or so, my work has revolved around exploring the question, how do we know what we know? And taking different historical answers to that question, things like empiricism, we know the world through direct sensory input, or memory, or introspection, or Eastern methods of seeking enlightenment, such as Buddhist chanting or Daimoku, and making paintings that test each of these different strategies for their veracity, their usefulness, their metaphorical implications, and in a sense, in a way to know myself better. In a way, as you think you might know a tree by its fruit, I certainly know myself and discover myself by the paintings that I make. At times, it's felt like I've created bodies of work where I felt like I was handed a mirror for the first time and realized that I was I would never quite see myself the same way again. So some of these works began, like the landscape paintings, for example, were explorations of my memory. How well could I demonstrate my understanding of the landscape from my childhood by memory? How clear is my memory? How accurate do I get it? And other pieces explored different types of epistemological questions. Where is the overlapping territory between the record of a physical touch and paint, the iconic representation it carries, and any symbolic content it might carry? Mm-hmm. Charles Saunders' Purse was a large influence for me in that sense. In the paintings of paintings, or meta paintings, I was interested in exploring other people's ideas in a way that both created a sort of reverence and recognition of another artist, but at the same time, a kind of absurd contradiction of my role in the work. For example, doing a painting of a Mondrian tipped in space at an angle. In one sense, it's reverently done and has a very admiring sort of feel to my commitment to loving Mondrian, whose work I love. But at the same time, it contradicts his work in just about every imaginable way, whereas Mondrian's work is decidedly flat, my work is decidedly illusionistic, where his work has a firm commitment to horizontal and vertical lines. My work makes a point of making his lines skew into diagonal angles, where his work is controlled within the bounds of the frame of the part-to-whole relationships in a kind of aesthetic orchestration. My work engages the name tag on the wall next to it as an extended rectangular element that echoes his work to suggest a kind of intertextuality in understanding his work. And then there's the ridiculous part of mimicking somebody's brushstrokes foreshortened in space. And so the surface of my canvas carries with it the physical record of my brushstroke, but my physical brushstroke is in some way an enactment of the mark that the original artist made, just foreshortened in space. And so when you look at the brushstroke on the painting, there's this absurd sense of whose touch is that supposed to be?
Yeah, that's actually such a fascinating thing, because that was before there were many restrictions put on how close you could get to paintings. I do love just getting my nose practically up to it to see the mark and to see the brush stroke, and then to step back and see, gosh, that brush stroke made this. So I think it's so interesting. So was it a lot of visits to museums to really study that, or?
Absolutely. I spend a lot of time in museums, and museums around the world have been very kind to me to allow me to take a tripod in, and people are very amused to see me photographing paintings without at an angle, not standing in front of it, thinking that I'm making a mistake. A lot of study.
It's kind of like goosebumps, you know, like, I don't know.
It's an amazing experience to study these artworks this carefully, and also to realize that as much as I am able to make a convincing illusion of one of their paintings in space, these folks were physically very different from me, and they painted in a way that embodied their way of working in ways that was unique to them, and just how startlingly and amazingly gifted some of these artists who deserve this incredible role in our pantheon of the arts.
You know, I want to kind of move on to your academic career. You actually taught at Valpo and then slowly moved into IU. So tell us a little bit about that. And then the additional part of that is, now that you have a new facility there, which is excellent, Michaela actually talked quite a bit about it, but I want you to tell, especially potential students and everything, about the beautiful facility you have at IU Northwest.
Yeah. So right out of graduate school, I taught briefly at Valpo as an adjunct faculty, but quickly found a full-time position here at IU Northwest, and have been connected with IU Northwest really for my whole career. And, you know, we mentioned earlier the question about me thinking of artists whose works I love. When I think of the most talented artist I've ever met, and I've spent a lifetime in the international art community, the first names that come to mind are some of my students. People who've walked in through the door as a freshman with no clear sense of who they were, who demonstrated themselves to be just brilliant and gifted artists who've gone on to have amazing careers. And it's just been an honor for me to work with.
You have a freshman who comes in, how do you guide or challenge a student to find their artistic voice? Because I don't think they probably all come in with knowing exactly what they want to do.
Well, almost none of them do. There's so much I can say about that. It would take another few hours. There isn't a cookie cutter answer to that, because there's so many different paths that people take. But one is to listen to them carefully and to expose them to other work, and to make sure that when they're working, that they're following the things that they want to do, rather than pushing them, other than learning a little bit of technical stuff at the beginning, other than trying to force them into something that isn't in alignment with their values and beliefs. But this is all so much better now that we've built this new building here on our campus. We have this spectacular new building for the arts, where we have individual studios for all intermediate and advanced level students, and just beautiful digital technology and sculpture and laser cutters and 3D printers and scanners and CNC routers and ceramics. And it's just a wonderful new environment to have here in Northwest Indiana.
And tell us about some of the facilities you have there, because it's greatly grown. I mean, you have something that's really very much on par and cutting edge.
Right. Well, we have beautiful theaters. We have a large main stage theater and a very flexible, beautiful black box theater. And we have a radio station where we make podcasts and broadcasts and our communication program. And we have printmaking facilities, multiple Mac labs, and a variety of different classrooms for each level of student. And the dirty arts and clean arts are pretty much separated on different ventilation systems. So the folks in graphic design don't have to choke on the dust that ceramics is producing, and other folks are given the freedom to weld and make a mess when it's called for.
Oh, that's so good.
And one of the things I was impressed with when I visited or worked there for a short time was the individual art spaces or studio spaces you have for students. You have, I think, about 20 of those or maybe a little bit more. I mean, those seem like a really productive place to, you know, have something.
Right. Yeah. I think there's even more than that. And it's such a wonderful opportunity for students to make that transition from carrying their work into a classroom to having their own space, build their own community together among other students, being able to leave their work up, talk to each other about their work, and learn from each other as well as learning from the faculty. So it's having those individual studio spaces is just very important. And also, our faculty also do much of their work, depending on who, some or all of it, here on campus. And so we hire students as assistants, and they get to work on works that end up in museums and seen around the world.
Well, you know, we're hitting that final minute. We want to give you a chance to talk about your upcoming exhibitions and also about the IUN program there in the arts.
Okay. Well, I am actively exhibiting as I have my entire adult life. And I'm in a show right now that's about to open at Gray Gallery in New York. I've been with Gray Gallery for 32 years. This is our 60th anniversary exhibition where they'll be showing 60 different artists that they've shown over the last 60 years. It was exhibited previously at their Chicago warehouse large gallery space. Programs. We are a comprehensive fine arts department with not only all the major areas that one would anticipate, but also the freedom for students to work in between. Students want to explore marketing and graphic design. They can do both at the same time, or they want to do painting and sculpture and biology. We open the doors for people to have experiences that are tailored to their interests and ambitions.
Excellent. How can we find you online and IUN online?
I think just Googling my name is the best way, and looking just iun.edu.
Excellent.
You can find us.
Well, we appreciate coming on Art on the Air. That's David Klayman. He's a Chancellor's Professor at IU Northwest, Dean of the Department of Art, and in the beautiful building there on Broadway, which is only a few years old and a great facility. David, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Karen Maravilla of It's Just Serendipity and an arts advocate, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Tammy Faber to Art on the Air. Tammy has had a long career with the Krazel Art Center in St. Joseph, Michigan. She has recently been named the new executive director and chief curator at the center, which is a well-respected fixture in the Southwest Michigan region. The Krazel's mission is to inspire meaningful change and strengthen community through the visual arts. Thank you, Tammy, for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome. Well, congratulations on the new title and responsibilities.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Tammy, like we like to do with all of our guests, we want to find out a little bit about you, actually, your whole origin story. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about Tammy.
Absolutely. So I actually grew up in Duluth, Minnesota. I always say that I'm very Midwestern. And I'm the youngest of six children, so we had a big family. I won't go into all of my origin story for you, but I will start with how I got interested in the arts, because I think that's what we're here to talk about today. When I was in the eighth grade, I had a really unique opportunity in that I had an art teacher who could see that I was very much enjoying the class I was taking and that I was having a great time with it. And he told me that when I got into the ninth grade, I should talk to the art teacher there because there was a brand new arts high school opening in the state of Minnesota, and they wanted to make sure that I knew about it. And that really led to me in the 11th and 12th grade moving from Duluth to a suburb of Minneapolis and living in dormitories and attending a free arts-run arts high school, a free state-ran arts high school, where you studied your academics in the morning and you studied art in the afternoons. You had access to art studios throughout the evening and in the early morning. And it was really a formative experience for me that really ingratiated me into the arts of all different kinds of mediums and techniques and really inspired me and led me really down the path today that I've taken to get where I am today. So that was a really great experience. And I don't know if you want to jump in and ask more questions or if you want me to just keep going for you, Larry.
Keep going. I appreciate it. Yeah, we want to follow your journey and then we'll kind of jump in and ask questions. That sounds like a wonderful, challenging thing to start with. But yeah, then how to decide to do an art career?
Yeah, so in arts high school, I really enjoyed my studio time, but I also recognized that I wasn't the most serious studio artist and that some of my interests really laid in writing and exploring art. And so I decided ultimately to study art history when I went to college. So first, I took a gap year, as we call it now, and I did some traveling and had some young adult experiences in life.
Where did you travel to?
I traveled just sort of throughout the Midwest, and I made some trips out east to Boston to see friends out there. I had a funny gig working at the Mall of America for a period of time, you know, all those things that you do when you're 18 and 19 years old. And then I went to the University of Minnesota Duluth. I went back to my hometown. I was actually helping care for a grandparent at that time, and so that just sort of coincided. And at the time, honestly, I was not excited to go to the University of Minnesota Duluth. I wanted to go further, but it worked out really well. And we actually had a really dynamic group of art history majors in my class. There were 11 of us, and we became a really tight-knit group. And we're really sort of a unique group in that every one of us went on to work in the arts after our college education, which is unusual. Many people don't stay in that career field. So I did that, and then I went back to Minneapolis-St. Paul, and I worked in museums there, both as I interned for a year and a half, and then through those internships, I received my first full-time paid museum position with the Minnesota Museum of American Art. And so that was really where I got into the museum field specifically.
And what was that first job? What was that first job in the museum?
Sure. I started out in 2000, I was hired as their visitor services coordinator. And what that meant for that museum was that I was overseeing all of the front desk staff and the little gift shop that was part of the front desk area at that museum. But then I was also coordinating the informal education program, so the docent program, summer camps, student art exhibits, a lot of things that we continue to do in the art world and here at Kressel Art Center. So I had a lot of great experience in the education portion of the museum. And then I was actually, a year later, they promoted me to assistant director of education. And I stayed in that position for a total of 3 years. And then after 3 years, I decided, you know, curatorial is really where I wanted to be working. I wanted to be developing exhibitions and working with artists. And so I left the working career after 6 years of being out of college. And I went back to graduate school at the age of 29. And at that time, I moved to Cleveland, Ohio, and I attended Case Western Reserve University. So they have a wonderful art history and museum studies program at Case, where you take all of your classes at the museum, and your professors are a combination of art history professors and curators.
Wow.
And so that was a really lovely, informative experience as well. I did a master's degree in art history and museum studies, and then I also worked as a teaching assistant and followed up with some adjunct teaching, and I actually wrote arts criticism for The Scene in Cleveland, as well as Angle Magazine, which were both free publications that covered the arts. And so I would do anywhere from a 1,500-word critique of an exhibition to what they called capsule reviews, which were 200 to 300-word reviews of shows. But it was a really great way to get really embedded into the art scene of Cleveland, Ohio, and to meet the different artists and get to know the different galleries and museums there.
great foundation for what you're doing now. I mean, what a great trajectory. It's
absolutely wonderful. I feel really fortunate. You know, I mean, it was classroom experience, but it was also a lot of hands-on experience too, and programmatic experience for sure.
And you worked there for a while, for a period of time. Is that while you were also studying, or did you do that after you graduated with your master's?
Okay, so I worked there as well. I did that while I was doing my master's degree. And I actually stayed on and went as far as my doctoral exams. Originally, I was going to pursue a PhD, and I ended at where my favorite academic acronym, ABD, all but dissertation. And then I decided it was I needed to move on. So that's actually when I headed towards CRASL.
So what brought you to that part of Michigan, you know, the Western Lake Board, so to speak?
Right. Well, I was looking for a museum position, and I was looking through the American Alliance of Museums, which is a national institution out of D.C. So they post museum positions, and the CRASL had posted nationally for their curatorial position. So I actually, you know, quite honestly, had never heard of the CRASL Art Center, had never been to St. Joseph Benton Harbor. So it was all new to me, but I applied for the position and came out to the area, and I was just really impressed, one, by the significance of arts and culture in this community, really impressed with the CRASL Art Center and the scope of the work that it was doing. And it really sort of spoke to my heart for both studio practice and art at the same time. You know, when I came for the interview, I met some really dynamic faculty right away who were teaching classes and saw their students coming and going. And I love that it's a little different than your typical quiet museum experience, right? You have galleries where you can see art and experience art, but you also have this really lively community of people coming and going at all times. And I really enjoyed that.
Well, and you get a lot of tourist traffic there in St. Joseph. So people that, you know, like come to the beach and everything like that might also come there. I mean, you have a beautiful view like in that bluff there overlooking the lighthouse and the beach area and everything like that. But that you might get people that are maybe not normally hitting the arts along there, where there's great dining and everything. That's
Right. So I think regionally the CRASL was one of the first museums, along with like St. Joseph in general, to have this great public sculpture. It was kind of like the leading force for a lot of, you know, now I think everybody's community has big public sculpture, but I seem to remember the CRASL kind of leading the way in that.
So tell us about the history of CRASL a little bit, you know, how it developed, what it was before, who founded it, and give us kind of the foundation story.
Absolutely. And before I do that, I just have to say, when I first started working here, one of my first summers here, I will never forget walking into the galleries, and there were two young people in their bathing suits in the galleries looking at the art. And I had this moment of like, I knew I was in a beach town. but I do love it. We are located, you know, we have a view. I can see Lake Michigan from my office window right now. It's a really unique position that we're in. The CRASL Art Center, actually, we opened our doors in 1980, but the foundation of CRASL Art Center began in the 1960s. So in 1962, there was a group of artists, the St. Joseph Art Association, and they got together and decided to do an art fair. And they literally did a clothesline art fair along Lake Bluff Park. And so they tied their clotheslines from tree to tree, and they got their clothespins, and they pinned up their artwork for people to come and look at and buy. And one of the artists involved in that very first exhibition was Olga CRASL. So Olga was local to this community. She lived here with her husband, George, and she was one of the founding members of that St. Joseph Art Association. Now, the art fair repeat has gone on every year since then, and it's become bigger and bigger each year, and just a real keystone community event. So she helped start that. She participated in it as an artist. She did beautiful floral paintings. And as a result, that artist association really kind of got organized and kept growing. Eventually, they had a house that they operated out of that had a few small galleries in it and some programs. And when her husband, George, passed away in the mid to late 70s, he left an endowment to start what is now the CRASL Art Center. So that gift is significant to our history. It's what really got us started as we're known today. And we opened our doors in 1980. So, and we've been on Lake Boulevard at 707 Lake Boulevard ever since then. We continue to do a lot of the same things, maybe just at a larger scale. You know, we have a dedicated gallery space for rotating exhibitions. We continue to do art classes for all ages, and we continue to put on the art fair every year. We're doing our 61st art fair this summer.
And I want to say, yeah, that the art fair, the quality of the work far exceeds any art fair in the region, and even, you know, into Indiana as well. I mean, the quality has always been superb and improves every year. Everybody's always excited to, and always, you know, because it's very, very selective process. So I have a lot of artists who keep trying all the time to, you know, to get in. So I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on developing sort of, I saw in your plan that you have bigger plans for the art fair on the Bluff. What can you share some of those? Like where you see that it's going to expand?
You know, I think that the art fair is a really interesting event. And we really, you know, with the pandemic and 2020, that really changed the field of art fairs in a lot of ways. You know, it at the time, several artists who were sort of on the tail end of their careers, some of them decided to get out of the art fair circuit at that time. So we do have artists that travel from art fair to art fair throughout the country. And so they're doing this. This is their year-round practice as well as making art. It's how they support themselves as artists. So we lost some of our, you know, diehard artists that had been in that field for years. And then we also had several people moving to online platforms. So we're really excited that we still have artists who want to come and be in our community and be outdoors on the Bluff. And I'm not certain that it's entirely accurate that we're changing the event in any significant way. I think, you know, we are still bringing in 172 artists this year. We've always brought in between 150 to 200. So we have 172 coming this year. And it's still on the Bluff and it's still outdoors. And as long as that model continues to work and we work well in the community with it, we're, you know, excited to continue that event. We really do see that as a cornerstone event, or a founding event, I should say. You know, some of the differences, we've refined the event in a few ways, you know, but we are still on Lake Bluff Park. We have gated the event just to keep the traffic flow a little different. You know, it used to be that both the park and the street would be closed off all weekend, and now we just close off the park and leave the street open for pedestrians. So when people want to get to the beach, but maybe not go to the fair, they have that way to do that. And people that specifically want to be at the fair can really be at the fair. There's a whole host of activities that go on in addition to the artists selling their artworks. We do have a collector's experience, which has a whole host of benefits with it, including a VIP lounge on our grounds right next to the beautiful Richard Hunt sculpture, Rising Crossing Tides. We have lots of things to do on our grounds and indoors art fair weekend that are free and open to the public, which includes local artists selling their artworks, including Water Street Glassworks and individual emerging artists. And we also always have an artwork activity going on the grounds. And this year, we think that will most likely be in our East Garden, which is just a wonderful space for people to come. It's really for, we call it the kids zone, but all ages come and they make an artwork and they take it home with them as part of the weekend's experience. There's lots of programming, lots of activities. Our galleries are open. People can come in and see the galleries, but then they can go into the fair and meet these artists that come every year from all over the country. So it's a really wonderful event. It's really fun, and it's very full and very lively.
Do you still have the teachers area? It used to have a booth for teachers' artwork. Is that still?
We've combined both our faculty, we call it the Faculty and Guild tent, and that is on our grounds. So that's free and open to the public, and anybody can come and experience that. And so that's teaching artists at Kraslow Art Center selling their artworks, as well as members of our Ceramics Guild, which is probably one of our most active studio spaces at the Kraslow Art Center. We have individuals who pay a monthly fee, and then they have access to our ceramic studios, and they come and they make their own ceramics and fire them, and then this is an opportunity for them to sell their artworks as well. So those two bodies are both on the grounds as part of Art Fair Weekend. Absolutely.
Great.
Back to your career just a little bit. You were at Crazzle for a while before you became executive director, and you succeeded someone who's still there, who moved into kind of a senior leadership, Julia Donahue. So tell us about that transition. That must be in some ways easy for you to have been there doing what you were doing with curating and then moving the executives and still have someone there to touch base with.
Absolutely. And it's, I think it's a really unique shift, and I'm kind of proud of it for our organization, because when I started in 2008, Julia was the director of education for Crazzle Art Center. She was eventually promoted to executive director, and I've worked with her throughout my entire career here, and she's a wonderful colleague and a wonderful person to work with. And we both kind of reached this point in our career where we're ready for a shift. And it also aligned with, you know, in this day and age of the economy and the need for financial security, we decided to make a shift. And the shift that we made is that Julia went from executive director to senior director of advancement. So she is focusing on making sure that the Crazzle Arts Center is financially sound through fundraising and development. And then I made the shift from just from curating and overseeing education to leading as the executive director. So we do. We still work side by side. We just had our morning coffee meeting today, like we do on a standing basis. And so there is some comfort to it. And there's also just some change as well. You know, I'm focusing on things that weren't particularly my focus in the past, but it's really great to really just delve in even deeper into this organization.
So I read your strategic plan, and in it, it's stated, I'm curious, what is your plan or what type of exhibition will you bring that will be a catalyst for social transformation? That was a big part of...
Absolutely. That's a big question. I love your research, Esther. I hope it's not just one exhibition, right? It's going to be multiple exhibitions, and it's going to be multiple ways that we reach into that. So, but I will give you an example of sort of a host of projects that will all be happening this summer that get into that. So, one, the Crazzle Arts Center just received a gift of 12 sculptures by the late artist Albert Laverne, who was an African-American artist working in Michigan. And we're really pleased to bring those sculptures into our collection. Those are on loan. We have a few of those on loan to Lake Michigan College right now. And we're also speaking with the African-American History and Literature Gallery about placing sculptures in their garden this summer. So that's one project. We are bringing in the artist Joy Davis from Berrien Springs to commission a special project by Joy specifically for our East Garden that is about transformation and beauty. And she is creating that as a summer-long installation. We also have two outdoor spaces that we're dedicating to our annual Pride project. So we commission an artist from the LGBTQ+ community to create artwork that we then reproduce and display graphically on two sets of doorways outdoors at Crazzle Art Center. And at the same time, indoors, we have a historic exhibition of art by Elizabeth Catlett, an iconic African-American artist. And we have a contemporary exhibition by Theda Sandiford, an artist of color from New York, who is creating artwork about emotional baggage and microaggressions. So I met Theda a year ago at Art Expo in Chicago. She had these really wonderful shopping carts that she had transformed with really common everyday materials like zip ties and plastic grocery store bags. And she called them her emotional baggage carts. And you could put your emotional baggage into the cart metaphorically. And she's also doing a project about microaggressions where people write out microaggressions they've experienced and they tie it to a net and it starts to reflect some of the concerns of the community. So that exhibition is on view this summer. And let me actually give you dates for that. That will open July 1st. And it's Theda Sandiford, Triggered Truth and Transformation. Going backwards in time, June 10th, we open Elizabeth Catlett in the main galleries. That will be on view for the summer. And then we have the East Garden and the Pride Project both on view by June as well. So a really diverse group of projects and artists that we hope are all catalysts for transformation. And we're developing program around that that component as well in that.
Yeah, and one you currently have that opened on April 15th through June 4th is Andy's Suites South Beach Show. And that's kind of an interesting thing. Tell us briefly about that in our last minute and a half that we have left.
Absolutely. So Andy Sweet was an artist who in his 20s, in the 1970s, he went to Miami Beach and he photographed an elderly Jewish community there that was quite eccentric and flamboyant and very fun, but also, you know, part of a community that went to a place that welcomed them and became a safe haven for them of sorts. And so it's an exhibition that, you know, we love because it resonates with our own beach culture, but it also gets into some deeper issues as well. So we will be opening that on Friday, April 14th. We'll do a preview party from 6 to 8 p.m. We're flying up the archivist, Ed Kristen, to be at the opening, who is very, very deeply involved in the Andy Sweet photo legacy. And it's just going to be a lot of very fun photographs from the 70s. And as I said, it has a lot of great content and meaning behind it as well.
I think we should end with an Olga Krasil quote of make life more worthwhile.
Yes. Oh, I love Olga. So Olga, when she was asked why she and George started an art center, part of her response, one of her responses was to make life more worthwhile.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing all about Krasil Art Center, which is 707 Lake Boulevard in St. Joseph on the beautiful bluff there. Tammy Frauver from the Krasil Museum, thank you so much for coming up on Art on the Air.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org, and Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on WDSO 88.3 FM. Our spotlight interviews are also heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Art in the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good, and you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.